Imagine for a second, right, that you are the CEO of a massive global corporation.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Yeah, and you spent your entire life building this thing. Your name is literally bolted onto skyscrapers across the world in these giant, you know, 50-foot gold letters.
Right, highly visible.
Exactly. You own golf courses, luxury resorts, all these licensing deals. It's a sprawling web of physical and intellectual property.
A global empire.
Right. And then suddenly, you are hired for the most demanding, heavily scrutinized public service job on the planet.
The presidency.
The presidency. So the question is, how do you separate your personal wealth from your public duty?
Yeah.
Like, when your name is the actual brand, is separation even functionally possible?
Well, it's an unprecedented diagnostic puzzle, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you look at historical American political frameworks, they were not built for that specific scenario. The system assumed a certain kind of politician with, you know, a very certain kind of wealth.
Like stocks and bonds.
Exactly. Not global hotel chains.
Which is exactly what we are tearing into today. We're doing a deep dive into the Trump family's business empire between the years 2015 and 2029.
It's a massive topic.
It really is. We're exploring this unprecedented collision of global commercial interests and the American presidency.
Yeah.
And to figure out how that actually works in practice, we're relying on excerpts from the Trump dossier 2015 to 2029.
Right, the new reference work.
Yeah, and what's fascinating about this massive historical record is that it completely strips away the political outrage.
It does. It's very clinical.
Totally. It's not interested in the daily cable news shouting matches at all. It just looks at the structural plumbing, like how the billions of dollars actually moved, how the institutions reacted, and whether this era permanently altered the norms of the highest office in the land.
And, you know, we need to be explicitly clear right at the outset here.
Yes, definitely.
This deep dive, much like the dossier itself, it takes absolutely no political sides. Our objective isn't to condemn or to endorse the actions taken during this 14-year period.
Right. No left-wing or right-wing spin here.
Exactly. We are just here to impartially unpack the facts, the highly complex legal frameworks, and the differing viewpoints provided in the source material. We want you, the listener, to understand the actual mechanics of the money and the power, regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because normally, when a president takes office, they use a blind trust.
Right. That was the established norm for decades.
And look, we all know the basics of a blind trust. You hand off your stock portfolio to an independent manager, so you can't play favorites with policy because you literally don't know what you own.
Right. The manager handles it completely blind to you.
But, and here's the kicker, you can't put a skyscraper into a blind trust.
No, you really can't.
You know it's there. You can literally see it from the street. So when Donald Trump won the 2016 election, how did the system even attempt to regulate an asset class that is just impossible to hide?
Well, it didn't, really.
It didn't.
No. And that is exactly where the historical deviation begins. In 2017, Donald Trump chose a path that completely bypassed that traditional expectation.
Okay, so what did he do instead?
Instead of liquidating his assets to create a true blind trust, he transferred the daily operational management of the Trump organization to his sons.
Right. Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump.
Exactly. They took over the hiring, the firing, the day-to-day deal making. But, and this is the crucial structural hinge for everything that follows in the dossier, he retained legal ownership of the enterprise.
Wait, so he still owned it completely?
Yes. The equity, the ultimate financial upside, all of that remained his.
So, okay, it's like owning a massive casino. You step down as the floor manager, you hand the keys to your kids, but you still keep your name on the building and you collect all the profits at the end of the year.
That's a really good way to visualize it.
Like, can you really claim you don't care who is gambling at the high roller tables just because you aren't actively watching the security cameras yourself?
That analogy hits the exact friction point of the entire 2017 to 2021 period. I mean, even if you isolate yourself from the operational decisions, the financial incentives remain perfectly intact.
Right. Because if the casino makes money, you make money.
Exactly. If the casino has a record-breaking month because a specific group of high rollers came in, your net worth still increases. And in the context of the presidency, those high rollers were often foreign diplomats, lobbyists, and state representatives.
Which naturally caused a massive uproar.
Oh, absolutely. Huh. This dynamic sparked a relentless 4-year wave of legal and parliamentary investigations. And they were almost entirely centered around a previously obscure secure part of the Constitution.
The emoluments clauses.
Right, the emoluments clauses.
Suddenly, everyone in 2017 was a constitutional scholar talking about emoluments.
Overnight.
But break down the actual mechanics of this for me. The founders were terrified of foreign kings buying influence, right?
Yes, very much so.
So they write these clauses to stop federal officials from accepting gifts or profits emoluments from foreign states. But how does an 18th century rule against, I don't know, accepting a jeweled snuff box from the King of France apply to a modern hotel room in Washington, D.C.?
Well, that was the exact legal battleground. The founders designed the Foreign Emoluments Clause to be a prophylactic measure. I mean, they were a fragile new republic.
Right.
And they knew European powers would try to compromise American diplomats through financial patronage, but they never envisioned a scenario where the President of the United States owned a commercial hospitality business down the street from the White House.
Right, like a fully functioning luxury hotel.
Exactly. So the legal question became, if the government of Saudi Arabia books a block of premium suites at the Trump International Hotel in D.C. and they are paying market rate, does that constitute a forbidden emolument?
I mean, it's a standard commercial transaction. They got a hotel room. They paid for it. It's not a chest of gold delivered to the Oval Office.
Exactly. And that was the defense's argument. They argued that fair market commercial transactions just don't count as emolument.
Like a burger is just a burger.
Right. If a foreign diplomat buys a burger at a Trump golf course, that's just business. But the watchdog groups and several attorneys general, they argued that the intent of the clause was broad.
Broad in what way?
That any financial transfer from a foreign state that enriches the president is a violation because it inherently creates a vulnerability to foreign leverage. And what's fascinating here is that this debate revealed a massive structural blind spot in the American ethical framework.
Because the watchdogs were basically showing up to a modern cyber warfare battle with muskets.
That's entirely accurate.
Like the tools they had were built for checking if a senator traded some oil stocks. Not for a president whose family is actively managing a global real estate conglomerate.
Precisely. The whole system just short-circuited. The Office of Government Ethics, the Congressional Oversight Committees, they relied on these standardized disclosure forms that might be filed, you know, once a year.
Once a year. That's way too slow.
Way too slow. They didn't have the legal precedent, the forensic accounting resources, or the statutory authority to monitor a sprawling private international LLC network in real time.
So what actually happened with all those lawsuits?
The legal battles over the emoluments clauses during the first term ultimately just bogged down in procedural questions, mostly about standing.
Standing, meaning like who is even allowed to sue the president over this?
Exactly. Rather than resolving the core constitutional question of what an emolument actually is in the modern world, they just fought over who had the right to ask the question in court.
Wow. Okay, so the first term is really characterized by this intense friction over physical assets. Hotels, golf courses, licensing deals.
Yes, tangible properties.
But as the dossier moves the timeline forward, we see this wasn't just a static situation, because once Trump leaves the White House in 2021, the entire paradigm shifts.
Dramatically.
We're no longer just talking about booking hotel suites. The family's business strategy undergoes this massive evolution from physical real estate to global investment funds.
Right. The post-presidency period, specifically 2021 to 2024, this is where we see what the dossier implies is the industrialization of political networking. And it focuses heavily on two central figures during this pivot.
Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr.
Exactly.
So let's start with Kushner. He was a senior White House advisor, heavily involved in Middle Eastern policy, you know, the Abraham Accords. He was deeply entrenched in the geopolitical strategy of the region.
Very deeply entrenched.
So he leaves office, and according to the dossier, he founds a private equity firm called Affinity Partners.
Right.
And then he lands a $2 billion anchor investment from the Saudi Public Investment Fund, the PIF.
$2 billion. And to truly understand the gravity of that, we have to look at the mechanics of how private equity actually works.
Okay, lay it out for us.
This isn't like someone buying $2 billion worth of stock in a public company where the value just, you know, floats on the open market. In private equity, the firm, in this case, Kushner's Affinity Partners, charges management fees just for holding and deploying the capital.
Just for holding the money.
Yes. Usually around 2% annually, plus a percentage of the profits later on, which is known as carried interest.
Wait, okay, let me do the math on that really quick.
Yeah.
2% of $2 billion is $40 million.
Yes.
So the firm is generating $40 million a year in baseline revenue. Just for managing the Saudi wealth fund's money. regardless of how well the underlying investments actually perform.
That is the standard industry structure, yes.
Yeah.
The baseline monetization is locked in the moment the check clears.
Wow.
And the dossier highlights a highly revealing internal dynamic regarding this specific investment. It notes that this allocation occurred despite serious reservations from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund's own internal screening panel.
Wait, really? Why were they hesitating? I mean, if you're the PIF, you have hundreds of billions under management. You invest in everything from Uber to professional golf leagues. Why balk at this one fund?
According to the source material, the internal screeners flagged the firm's inexperience.
Oh, because it was brand new.
Exactly. Affinity Partners was a brand new entity. Kushner had a background in real estate and politics, not a proven track record of managing multi-billion dollar private equity portfolios.
Right.
So the screeners raised concerns about the firm's operations and what they considered an outsized risk. But those internal objections were overridden by the highest levels of Saudi leadership.
Specifically, the Crown Prince.
Yes, who personally authorized the allocation.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, because I can hear someone yelling at their phone right now.
Go for it.
Isn't this just what former politicians do?
Mm-hmm.
Like Bill Clinton gave speeches to foreign banks for $500,000 a pop.
Right.
Barack Obama signed massive production deals with Netflix.
Mm-mm.
Board seats, memoirs, consulting gigs. Cashing in on your Rolodex is basically a bipartisan tradition in Washington.
It absolutely is.
So are we just pearl-clutching over Kushner's private equity fund because the numbers have a couple of extra zeros? Or is the mechanism fundamentally different here?
Well, that is exactly the pushback the dossier addresses, and it's vital to parse the difference here. Yes, the monetization of the post-presidency is a long-established norm. Nobody disputes that.
Right.
But the difference between a paid speech and a sovereign wealth fund anchor investment is not just a matter of scale. It's a matter of structural entrenchment.
Structural entrenchment? How so?
Think about it like this. When a former president gives a speech for a flat fee, the transaction is closed. You speak for an hour, the bank cuts a check, you shake hands, the relationship ends.
Clean break.
Exactly. But a private equity fund is an ongoing, multi-year, structurally binding financial partnership.
Because they are holding the money for years.
Years, often a decade. The Saudi PIF isn't just handing over money. They become the dominant limited partner in the firm's entire ecosystem. Kushner's firm is now functionally reliant on a foreign state apparatus that he previously negotiated with on behalf of the United States government.
Oh, I see.
It moves the monetization from a localized individual level to an institutional geopolitical level.
It's the difference between buying a guy a beer to pick his brain and entering into a 10-year business marriage with him.
That's a perfect way to put it. Exactly. And while Kushner was securing Gulf capital, Donald Trump Jr. was pivoting in a different but parallel direction domestically.
Right. The dossier talks about 2024 for him.
Yes. In 2024, the dossier notes he became a partner at 1789 Capital.
1789 Capital. Now, this is the firm branding itself as backing America First businesses.
Yeah.
Right? Which is fascinating because it's not just standard venture capital where you just look for the best tech startup. It's explicitly ideological. They are intentionally trying to build this parallel economy of conservative-aligned companies.
Right. It's an ideological thesis applied to private equity. The strategy is to identify companies that cater to a conservative demographic, perhaps businesses that feel alienated by mainstream corporate ESG policies, you know, environmental, social, and governance rules.
And inject them with massive capital.
Exactly. By bringing Donald Trump Jr. on board, the firm isn't just acquiring his business acumen. They're explicitly acquiring his political brand.
His name.
His name and his direct access to a highly motivated base of consumers and potential investors.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting. Because you have this massive financial infrastructure being laid down between 2021 and 2024.
Yes.
You have the Middle Eastern sovereign wealth ties through Kushner. You have the domestic ideologically driven private equity through Don Jr.
The foundation is set.
Right. But then the 2024 election happens. We enter a second Trump term. And according to the dossier, the years 2025 and 2026 don't just see a continuation of these businesses, we see an absolute explosion.
A massive acceleration.
And a hard pivot into the digital frontier.
Right. The transition from physical to digital assets during the second term is perhaps the most legally confounding period detailed in the entire dossier.
Legal nightmare.
Completely. Financial disclosures and aggressive reporting from outlets like Reuters showed a massive spike in the family's revenue. We are talking about income streams from licensing and digital projects that didn't just grow, they skyrocketed.
The numbers in the dossier are wild.
They are, in some metrics, crossing the $1 billion mark.
$1 billion. While holding the office of the presidency.
Yes.
And we aren't talking about selling luxury condos in Manhattan anymore. We are talking about cryptocurrencies and NFTs, non-fungible tokens.
The digital pivot.
So walk me through the mechanics here. Because if a sitting president launches a branded crypto token or a digital trading card, how does that fundamentally alter the dynamic of foreign investment compared to, say, someone booking a room at the Trump Hotel in D.C.?
It alters it completely by stripping away all the physical bottlenecks of traditional finance.
Okay, what do you mean by physical bottlenecks?
Well, let's go back to your hotel example.
Right.
If a foreign entity wants to funnel, say, $1 million to the president through a hotel, they have to physically book rooms.
Right, there's a paper trail.
A massive paper trail. There are credit card processing companies involved. Those are subject to stringent KYC, know your customer laws, and anti-money laundering laws.
Real banks are watching.
Exactly. There are property managers, there are maids who know if the rooms are actually empty or not, and local tax authorities tracking the revenue. It is highly visible and highly regulated.
But with crypto.
With crypto and NFTs, those bottlenecks just evaporate.
Wow.
Digital tokens can be purchased instantly from anywhere on Earth using decentralized exchanges that often do not require any identity verification.
So no KYC laws.
Exactly. A foreign intelligence service or a corporate lobbying group, they could theoretically use a shell wallet to purchase millions of dollars worth of a politically branded digital asset in seconds.
And no one would know who they are.
Right. The capital flow is rapid, global, decentralized, and deliberately obfuscated by the architecture of the blockchain itself.
So you have a mechanism where money can be transferred directly into a political family's ecosystem with near total anonymity.
Near total.
I mean, you can trace the wallet address on the blockchain, sure, everyone can see the ledger, but you have no idea who actually holds the private keys to that wallet. It could be a teenager in Ohio, or it could be a state-sponsored oligarch from overseas.
Precisely. You see the movement, but not the identity. And this is why the traditional oversight mechanisms essentially threw their hands up.
What could they even do?
Nothing, really. How does a Congressional Ethics Committee subpoena the identity behind an anonymous string of alphanumeric characters on a decentralized ledger?
They can't.
They absolutely can't. And simultaneously, while this digital gold rush is happening, the traditional private equity vehicles were also surging.
Right, the domestic side.
Remember 1789 Capital, the firm Don Jr. joined?
Right, the America First Fund.
The dossier cites Reuters reporting that after he joined and as the second administration took power, the firm's assets under management just exploded.
By how much?
It grew from roughly $150 million to over $1 billion.
That is exponential growth for a relatively new fund. And this is where the friction of holding office really comes into play, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Because if a company backed by 1789 Capital, a company that the president's son has a massive financial stake in, starts bidding on federal government contracts, how does the system handle that?
With extreme panic.
Because it's completely new territory.
Yes. Because again, the laws just weren't built for this. If a defense contractor is partially owned by a private equity fund, which is in turn partnered with the president's family, does awarding that contractor a Pentagon grant violate conflict of interest laws?
The optics are terrible.
Terrible. The media, the watchdogs, they were ringing the alarm bells constantly. And the physical real estate expansion didn't pause during this time either.
Oh, they kept building.
Yes. The dossier notes major simultaneous expansions of physical projects in places like Oman, Vietnam, and across the broader Gulf region.
Which brings us to the core tension of this entire 14-year period.
The big question.
Right. You have billions of dollars moving through sovereign wealth funds.
Yeah.
You have exploding private equity valuations, massive international real estate deals, anonymous cryptocurrency drops.
Just a lot.
It's a dizzying amount of money.
Right.
And the natural immediate reaction from the public and the media is to scream, how is this legal?
Right.
But the dossier forces us to take a step back, right? To apply a very rigorous, almost clinical framework to that question.
It does. It is the most vital analytical distinction in the entire source text. The dossier explicitly requires us to separate the ethical from the legal.
Separate the ethical from the legal.
Yes. It states very clearly ethical questions, no matter how severe or unprecedented they seem, do not automatically mean a legal violation has occurred.
So we have to separate what is actually proven fact from what is just unproven, albeit highly suspicious, allegation.
Exactly.
Let's run through the columns then. What are the established, undisputed facts on the ground, according to the dossier?
Okay, the proven facts are these. One, Donald Trump retained ownership and financial benefit from his enterprises while in office.
Sorry.
Two, his children actively managed and expanded those operations, leaning heavily into his political brand.
Fact.
Three, the family launched massive international investment funds that secured billions in capital from foreign state actors, including nations the administration directly interacted with diplomatically.
Right, like Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. And finally, it is a fact that these actions triggered multiple exhaustive congressional and legal investigations into conflicts of interest.
Okay, so those are the documented realities. No one disputes those.
Correct.
Now, what sits in the unproven column? Because this is where the distinction really matters for the legal side.
What remains legally unproven, meaning it has never been definitively established in a court of law, is that any specific business transaction resulted in a direct, actionable political favor.
Right. There is no proven quid pro quo.
Exactly.
So no smoking gun email saying, approve this weapon sale and we will invest $2 billion in your fund.
Correct. No smoking gun. Furthermore, it is legally unproven that the foreign investments or the crypto purchases were exclusively the result of illicit influence peddling.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to just aggressive, opportunistic business ventures by the family. They were leveraging their fame, certainly, but legally proving criminal intent is a massive hurdle.
I keep coming back to a sports analogy for this.
Let's hear it.
It's like a basketball player who spends months studying the rule book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they figure out that there is technically no rule against carrying the ball as long as you bounce it off an opponent's shoe every three steps.
Okay, a loophole.
Exactly. So they just start doing it, and it completely breaks the flow of the game. The audience is booing, the opposing team is furious, the commentators are screaming that it ruins the spirit of the sport.
Right, the ethics of the game.
But the referees are just standing there flipping through the rule book, realizing that technically, it isn't a foul.
That is a brilliant encapsulation of the systemic paralysis of the 2020s.
Just staring at the rule book.
Exactly. The legal discussion during these years rarely centered around, did they break a specific law? The legal panic was, are our current laws so utterly inadequate that we can't even legally define what is happening?
Wow.
If the ethical thermometer only goes up to 100 degrees, you can't officially certify that the water is boiling at 212. You just watch it boil over.
And because the legal system couldn't provide a clean binary answer, you know, guilty or not guilty, legal or illegal, the public's understanding of this entire era had to come from somewhere else.
Right. It fell entirely into the lap of the media.
And this is where the dossier provides a fascinating meta-analysis, because the media did not handle this as a monolith at all.
Not even close. The sheer complexity and scale of the Trump family's business ecosystem meant that no single newsroom could cover the whole thing.
It was too big.
Too big, too complex. So the media fragmented, with different outlets taking entirely different approaches to how they frame the narrative.
It's like five blindfolded people touching different parts of an elephant and trying to describe the animal.
Exactly.
You had Reuters basically acting as forensic accountants. They were the ones digging into the SEC filings, tracking the crypto wallets, looking at the exact asset growth of 1789 Capital.
Right. They were obsessed with the hard data and the plumbing of the money.
Meanwhile, the Associated Press took the archivist approach, right?
Yes. Their reporting constantly contextualized the events historically. They were always comparing the Kushner-Saudi deal or the crypto launches to precedents set by past administrations, continually highlighting just how radically this deviated from the traditional blind trust.
Constantly looking backward,
yeah,
to compare.
Exactly.
Then you had the New York Times pulling their hair out over the ethical implications.
They functioned as the moral philosophers of the era.
Right, focusing intensely on the blurring lines between public service and private enrichment, constantly questioning the morality of the arrangement, especially during that second term's digital pivot.
And you can contrast that with the financial press, like the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times.
How did they handle it?
They viewed this almost entirely through a geopolitical lens. They weren't as focused on the domestic ethics. They were analyzing what it means for global markets when states like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, or the UAE deploy sovereign wealth into a sitting or former president's family network.
Looking at the macro effects.
Exactly. How does that alter global trade dynamics?
And finally, you have Forbes just sitting there with a calculator, acting as the scorekeepers.
Basically.
Just mapping out the pure net worth fluctuations of the family members year over year.
But despite this fragmented coverage, the dossier distills the actual public and political reaction down to three distinct standpoints.
Okay.
And these three perspectives essentially capture the entirety of how modern society digested this unprecedented era.
Let's break those down. The dossier lays out standpoint A, B, and C.
Right.
So standpoint A, this is the perspective of Donald Trump, his family, and his political supporters. What is their core argument here?
Standpoint A argues that no conflict of interest exists fundamentally because the operational separation was maintained.
Because the kids are running it.
Exactly. The kids run the daily operations. The president is not sitting in on pitch meetings for 1789 Capitol. And therefore, the family has a constitutional right to continue earning a living and growing their enterprise.
But there is a deeper political argument embedded in standpoint A, too, isn't there? It's the argument of the Democratic mandate.
Yes, that is the crux of their defense.
Yeah.
They argue that the American voters had perfect information.
They knew who they were voting for.
Exactly. They knew Donald Trump was a global businessman with vast, untethered assets in 2016. They watched the debates over the emoluments clauses for 4 years. They saw the Kushner investments and the Don Jr. private equity pivots.
Hey, all public.
All public. And knowing all of that, they still elected him again in 2024. Therefore, standpoint A argues, winning the election provides a Democratic mandate that overrides the complaints of unelected ethics watchdogs.
So the voters approved the arrangement at the ballot box.
The ultimate absolution by the electorate.
Okay, that makes sense from their view. Then we have standpoint B, the critics.
Standpoint B is the exact inverse. They argue that the lines between public power and private interest haven't just blurred. They have been completely obliterated.
Obliterated?
From this perspective, when the Saudi PIF invests $2 billion, or when foreign investors buy anonymous digital tokens, they are not looking for standard market returns.
They aren't just trying to make a quick buck on crypto.
No. Standpoint B argues they are explicitly using these commercial channels to buy political access, favorable foreign policy, and regulatory relief.
So it's the fear of acute transactional corruption. Like, if the guy sitting across the negotiating table from you in a diplomatic summit also holds the key to a multi-billion-dollar real estate project your family is building in Oman, you cannot possibly negotiate objectively on behalf of the American people. That is standpoint B.
Precisely. It assumes bad faith and direct leverage.
Cut.
But then there is standpoint C, which the dossier attributes to independent experts, constitutional scholars, and former government ethics officials.
How does standpoint C differ from the acute panic of standpoint B?
It zooms out. Standpoint C argues that the hunt for a smoking gun, you know, the obsession with finding a direct quid pro quo, misses the forest for the trees.
How so?
The core issue isn't whether you can prove a crime in court. The core issue is institutional trust.
Institutional trust.
Yes. A functioning democracy relies entirely on the public's baseline belief that government decisions are being made in the national interest, not for the leader's personal financial gain.
Oh, I see. So even if everything is completely above board,
right?
Even if Kushner's fund generates incredible returns for the Saudis through sheer financial genius, and even if the crypto tokens are just fun digital collectibles, the appearance of a conflict is destructive enough on its own.
Exactly. If the public believes a tariff was lifted to protect a family trademark, or a military deployment was altered to protect a family golf resort in the Gulf, the institutional trust erodes, regardless of the actual truth.
Because perception becomes reality.
Exactly. Standpoint C argues that this era fundamentally damaged the credibility of the executive branch. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's vital to view this through the lens of the foreign nations involved, too.
That is a great point, because why are nations like Saudi Arabia or Qatar pouring billions into these specific funds? We tend to view it domestically as this sinister plot to subvert American democracy.
But from the perspective of Riyadh or Doha, it might simply be viewed as pragmatic statecraft.
Pragmatic.
Yes. They are dealing with a U.S. administration that operates heavily on transactional loyalty and personal relationships.
Right.
So if the American legal and political system allows this channel of commercial engagement, why wouldn't a foreign power use it?
Just playing the hand they're dealt.
Exactly. They aren't trying to break the American system. They're just adapting to the reality of the landscape faster than the U.S. oversight committees could.
Which is an incredibly sobering thought. It means the global order recognized the new rules of the game and started playing by them, while American ethics watchdogs were still arguing over the old rulebook.
Which brings us to the ultimate question of legacy.
Right.
When we step back from the specific investments, the media fragmentation, and the crypto ledgers, What does this 14-year period actually mean for the history books?
The dossier poses this overarching question, right? Like, was this massive business growth simply a legitimate, albeit aggressive, continuation of a pre-existing family enterprise? Or did this combination of global power and private commerce permanently alter the norms of the American presidency?
The undeniable consensus of the historical record presented in the dossier is that the period from 2015 to 2029 forced a foundational reevaluation of how political power, family business, and personal wealth can intersect.
It changed everything.
It didn't just bend the mold, it shattered it.
Because it proved that the system was built on an illusion.
Exactly. It proved that the guardrails of the American presidency, the expectation of the blind trust, the strict separation of public and private spheres, they relied almost entirely on tradition, political shame, and gentlemen's agreements.
Just handshakes and norms.
Right. It relied on politicians voluntarily adhering to norms because they feared the political blowback. But once a leader emerged who was immune to that specific type of political shame and who recognized that the actual enforceable laws were incredibly weak,
the system just folded.
It had no hard enforcement mechanism to fall back on.
The emperor didn't just have no clothes. The watchdogs had no teeth.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this deep dive? I really want you to reflect on your own expectations as a citizen. Does hearing this structural breakdown make you view future presidential candidates differently?
It should.
Will we ever go back to the era where we expect a politician to quietly place their mutual funds into a blind trust? Or is that era completely over? Is the new baseline that a president will just naturally possess a sprawling global financial portfolio, and we just have to accept the inherent conflicts?
Understanding how deeply power and money intertwine at this institutional level is what makes you a critical consumer of history and news.
Absolutely.
The next time you read a headline about a sudden shift in foreign policy, a new trade tariff, or a major diplomatic summit in the Middle East, you now have the conceptual tools to look past the political rhetoric.
You have to ask yourself, what is the broader commercial ecosystem surrounding the decision makers in that room?
Always follow the structural plumbing.
Right. We've covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with the initial refusal of the blind trust back in 2017, the keeping of the ownership keys while handing off the day-to-day management.
Right.
We explored the constitutional limitations of the emoluments clauses and how they totally failed to regulate a modern hospitality empire.
We moved through the post-presidency pivot from 2021 to 2024, examining how figures like Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. shifted the family's monetization strategy away from physical real estate and toward massive, institutionally backed private equity funds securing billions from sovereign wealth.
And then we broke down the explosion of the second term, that hard pivot into decentralized cryptocurrencies and NFTs, and how that digital shift completely bypassed traditional financial oversight.
And we navigated the incredibly tense chasm between what is technically legally proven in a court of law and what is historically and ethically sound.
It is a story of a profound structural shift. It is the story of a system being stress tested to its absolute limits by a family that perfectly understood the difference between a broken norm and a broken law.
Very well said.
But I want to leave you with a final lingering thought. A question inspired by everything we've read in the dossier, but taking it one step further into the reality we are living in today.
This raises the most important question for the future of democratic oversight, honestly.
We spent all this time talking about how hard it was for the watchdogs, the journalists, and the congressional oversight committees to track physical hotels, licensing deals, and traditional private equity funds.
Right. They were completely overwhelmed just trying to follow standard bank wires and SEC filings.
But looking to the future, if modern political leaders are now building wealth through decentralized cryptocurrencies, blockchain technology, and truly anonymous digital assets, how will future transparency laws ever have a chance?
They might not. I mean, if the capital flows become entirely frictionless and untraceable, the traditional X-ray machine we talked about at the very beginning isn't just broken. The disease it's trying to diagnose has become completely invisible.
Exactly. Have we already entered an era where the political wealth of our global leaders is completely structurally untraceable? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems, keep looking past the headlines, and keep examining the mechanics of the world around you.